Hi, Connor.
Hey, Bob, how you doing?
Can't complain. We should be polite and introduce ourselves. I'm Robert Wright, publisher and editor-in-chief of the Non-Zero Newsletter. You're Connor Eccles, managing editor of the Non-Zero Newsletter. This is the Non-Zero podcast, or strictly speaking, this is Non-Zero World,
Right.
the weekend edition of the Non-Zero podcast, which has some overlap substantively with the weekend edition of the Non-Zero Newsletter, which is called The Earthling. And Non-Zero World is in a period of transition. Its identity is morphing as a
Right.
result of recent personnel changes. And I think you'll agree with me that we're going to do something radical with it that is going to rock the very foundations of the podcast industry. Do you think that's going too far?
I'd like to think that we will rock the very foundations of perhaps the whole country. I mean, you might be able to actually hear
Well,
it when it happens.
yeah. I mean, yeah, no, there's a real chance that, but I'm just kind of an under promise, over deliver kind of guy. So I just thought I would say we're going to rock the foundations of the podcast industry and leave it at that for now.
Yeah, I think that's ambitious enough, but we don't want to have listeners think that we're kind of shooting for a middle ground, right? We need to be going all the way.
You think it sounds a little too, yeah. I see your point. I see your point. Yeah, okay. Total world dominance. What are we gonna talk about? We're gonna talk about the Earth. Now, we should say, you are in, what is it, week four of this 6 week period during which I'm spending an inordinate amount of time or an unusual amount of time trying to finish a book. And that means that you are, I think you came up with this name, guest editor of The Earthling. And so I've seen most of this week's Earthling I have not seen. So I'm just reacting in real time to most things you say about it. And if I react intelligently, that's just a testament to my spontaneity.
Well, we'll have lots to talk about from that. I know that you want to talk about both this like USAID sort of attack. From Doge, from all that, and sort of the media coverage of it, some other stuff. We're probably going to talk a little bit about the tariff back and forth with Trump, and also the sort of pause on clean energy spending, and even one very, very interesting development in the Middle East that I think has gone just totally under remarked, but that could be really transformative. So lots of good stuff.
And you mentioned AI, right?
And AI, well, it's always AI, right? You know,
It goes
if
without saying that Bob is going to talk about AI.
we will bring it in that direction one way or another.
A big development this week.
Absolutely. Well, do we want to start off with the USAID stuff?
Yeah, what you want to tell us kind of what the state of play of USAID, it's hard to keep track of everything that's getting crushed these days, but
So it's been a, I mean, this has been a particular target of the sort of so-called Department of Government Efficiency run by Elon Musk in the early days of the Trump administration. You know, it's part of this. There is a long-standing sort of tradition on parts of the right, and especially on the America First thing, that foreign aid, which USAID is the main agency that does America's foreign aid, is sort of on its face wrong because we're spending American money on things that aren't American, right? And so, stemming from that, there's been a pretty full frontal attack on the existence of USAID. Marco Rubio is now the acting administrator, and it's been sort of demoted, at least temporarily. It's not clear if this is legal, but almost been demoted from being an agency at all, despite having been created by Congress, or at least authorized by Congress. And they've gone from about 13,000 employees, all around the world, employees and contractors. And now they have furloughed the vast, vast majority of those. There's roughly 300. It's the whole make government small enough to strangle it or whatever kind of argument. So that's kind of where things stand. Smart people I've seen talking about it say that it's not clear that this is the death of USAID. There's a lot of stuff that could still happen to revive it, but it has been far and away one of the biggest targets. And I guess one more thing I would add is that there's been a lot of attention in conservative media to the various different groups that have received money from USAID. Some of those have identified, you know, ones that may genuinely be more controversial. Others have been sort of a lot of spread of conspiracies around sort of payments to Politico and things like that, which is really just because USAID has, you know, subscriptions to the to Politico Pro, which is like, you know, a Bloomberg terminal for government. So there's been a lot swirling, but there's been an intense focus on sort of every line item in that USAID budget.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what I was going to say was actually stimulated by a question we got last night when we did the Zoom call with Non-Zero Newsletter members. That was fun. And one of them asked about press coverage of this whole opening phase of Trump chaos, because I've traditionally been a critic of the way mainstream media covers Trump, you know, to kind of reflexively resistancy in a way that doesn't successfully kind of cover the big picture of what's going on and what kind of the roots of Trumpism are and so on. And at the same time, just kind of arouses more counter resistance by virtue of being so obviously anti-Trump. And somebody asked me, what do you think of the press coverage this time around? And I said I hadn't thought about it much, but it actually in a way seemed less subject to that criticism than last time, if only because Trump is himself being more extreme this time, or at least being he's compressing more extremism into a small period of time. But then afterwards, I thought, I wondered, and maybe you would know whether this kind of piece has appeared, and I wondered whether it's the kind of piece in the newsletter should be doing. Because I wondered, has there been a good balanced objective view of USAID that just explains what the different criticisms are? Because, for example, there's a left-wing criticism that kind of converges with parts of the right-wing criticism or parts of some right-wingers' criticisms, which is that it is used as a tool of American empire, to put it the way the left might put it, right? It's used strategically, like you may be more likely to get aid if your country is run by a regime we approve of, or a regime we're trying to steer in our direction, and so on. And, you know, and I should say, I don't really know that much about USAID, but I gather that sometimes the aid even assumes the form of like, supporting what USAID would call institutions of civil society or something, but that are aimed at a regime we don't like, right?
Right.
Like the U.S. government was supporting these civil society groups that helped bring the president down in 2014 in what turned out to be what I think you could call a violent overthrow. I mean, he fled for fear of his life. And that we planned that when we set up these groups, but the point is, this is why you get this kind of criticism. So, you know, there's more than one kind of criticism. I mean, one is why should, you know, the American first criticism is, why should we be helping these people who aren't Americans? Now, in some cases, there's a very good answer, which is that, you know, we're monitoring contagious diseases that, yeah, it's good for them, but it's also preventing a pandemic. That's good for us.
Right.
And then there are cases and the other kinds of, you know, things that don't have any immediate obvious benefit for Americans, maybe are legitimately subject to the American first criticism, if you buy American first premises. I guess a kind of criticism you could make is like, even of the stuff that is altruistic, it's not about regime change, that it just helps people, education, health, and so on, you could say, but it's still not fair because it is governed by strategy. In other words, why are we helping this country and not other countries? To which I would say, look, if it's a motivation for helping other people, even if it winds up being kind of unbalanced in terms of who we help, I'm okay with it because, you know, otherwise we just wouldn't help anybody. In other words, yeah. However cynical these strategic motivations may seem, they do lead us to help people in much worse circumstances than the average American. And I'm not against that. But I was just wondering, I would be surprised, but maybe there's been one, if there's been a New York Times or Washington Post piece that kind of gets into all this stuff with particular emphasis on the left-wing critique, which we're not hearing much about at all. I mean, if you pay attention to the Glenn Greenwalds of the world, now some people may say he's gone over to the Trump side or whatever, but you know, leftists in that tradition, you know, there are these points of convergence where they're echoing some of the criticisms of USAID. I'd like to see a piece that explains that, you know, that. Yeah. Have you seen one in...
I have not seen one that really like takes all of the critiques on both sides. To your point, I think that there is a lot of sort of reactiveness in the media space around this. And part of that is that, you know, this fits into the whole broader idea of exactly whether the extent to which we should be freaking out right now, is that, you know, Trump has this first mover advantage right now. He was able to plan things during the transition in a way that he didn't the first time around. And he is doing all of these things really quickly all at once. And it feels very like overwhelming. And there's just a lot of news to cover, right? Mm-hmm. So I guess that is part of the challenge. There's been, if people want a detailed version of the left-wing critique, there was a popular piece this week by Almut Roshawansky in Jacobin. Oh, yeah. You've had her on the podcast.
Who's been on the podcast. Yeah, she's great.
Yeah, and she sort of laid out the left-wing version, which, you know, as you said, is sort of this idea that it is artificially holding up these civil society organizations in other countries that are sort of almost like a compromised colonial elite is sort of maybe how a hard leftist might phrase it, right? Mm-hmm. Is that it's these people who are focused, their ideas are influenced and in conversation with the West and have much less to do with realities on the ground within the country. That would be
right.
The argument. And so you see that a lot. And then, yeah, on the right, they'll point out all the sort of just programs that have been added over the years where the utility is sort of unclear. But I mean, there are real challenges because, again, you know, USAID, for example, in 2020 bought, I believe, $2 billion worth of food from American farmers for food aid abroad. There's over $300 million worth of food aid, mostly grain, sitting at American ports, not going abroad right now. That risks spoiling, and like those are just real active problems that I don't know have been taken into account in the Musk approach to USAID.
Yeah, no, the kind of Silicon Valley worship of moving fast and breaking things is getting a little out of hand here. So that was kind of my. I'm guessing there hasn't been a good balanced piece. It would be a good subject for you know, kind of a deep dive, even that tries to even get into the proportions, you know, like how much sounds like it's this stuff like the left would object to, you know, if you just look at like categories of expenditure, if that's available. But anyway, that was my thought. I mean, if we can't find this piece, maybe we should find somebody to do it.
Yeah, no, I think that'd be a good idea. I mean, I will note one thing that would make its way in to that type of piece is that a huge proportion of the funding for USAID is, or a significant proportion, is spent in the U.S. On sort of contractors and various things like that. Yeah. But I think the status of all of that is definitely sort of wait and see, like lots of other Trump things where, you know, it's Congress has created this agency. It's not at all clear that it can be destroyed. These workers are furloughed. They're not fired. They could be brought back. But there's, you know, significant reason for concern in the short term.
Yeah, I had wondered whether all the contractors involved in government expenditure would lead to blowback for Trump of the spending freeze, the separate spending freeze that I think was rescinded. I don't know whether under pressure of court order or what, but I think that's not operative at the moment, at least. I was just kind of thinking, like, I'll bet there's a lot of people on the Red Tribe who, you know, they work, who just would get unsettled, you know, or who are hurt by that one way or another, contractors in particular, and Trump might pay the price. So maybe he was lucky if he got kind of coerced into rescinding that.
Yeah. Yeah, we shall see. We shall see. Do we want to do another? I mean, while we're on Trump and foreign policy, you know, another very big line from this week has obviously been Trump's sort of impromptu plan to depopulate the entirety of Gaza and have America take it over, I guess, is the current line. I almost don't even know what to say about it. It's so sort of off the wall.
It's, you know, trying to figure out what's going on in his head is just a full-time occupation. I mean, for example, he is said to really cherish the goal of normalizing relations between Israel and Saudi Arabia.
Right.
And, you know, as part of the Abraham Accords. And Saudi Arabia responded to this by issuing a statement saying, among other things, reiterating that they would not normalize relations with Israel until there's a Palestinian state. Now, that's a problem for Trump if he wants to, because every time they repeat that, it means they have to wait longer to go back on that promise, right? And the more prominently they put it out there, the more it complicates, you know, because they're going to have to go back on the promise if they're going to normalize relations. It's not going to be a Palestinian state. I mean, I don't know what this is going to be, but it's not going to be a two-state solution like during Trump's tenure. And so you just ask, like, and this is just, like, obvious, you know. You don't have to be a full-time student of the Middle East to see this coming, right? And know that Saudi Arabia has to take some kind of stand against what looks a lot like the ethnic cleansing of Gaza. And yet, I guess Trump didn't see it. You know, people say, no, Trump's actually smart. You know, he's got like this social intelligence, this political intelligence. I just don't think smart is really the word for this, because this is just simple. This isn't like nine-dimensional chess we're talking about, you know? If you really have a social and political intelligence, which means understanding the perspective of other people at least enough to exploit and manipulate them, you know, again, you should see this coming. It's just do you have a theory? I mean, the reporting was this hadn't been vetted widely in the administration. Supposedly, Bibi himself was caught off guard. I think the only way you'd know that is if he said it, and I wouldn't take his word for it, so I don't know about that. But would you have a theory
of where the idea comes from?
What's going on in his head? I mean, what is the? Repeated treating of America as if it were a large corporation. You know, he talks about a lot of things that way, Canada, Greenland. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's one version where you kind of, in terms of the idea of America actually taking over Gaza, I think that is an extension of the positive feedback that he has gotten from his base around taking over Greenland, around taking over the Panama Canal, Canada as well. He's gotten a lot of positive feedback about that, and Trump is very responsive to positive feedback. So that's my best guess there. On the other side, and this is something that I mentioned in a piece that originally ran in the Non-Zero newsletter last year, and then an updated version after Trump's election ran in the Washington Post. And it talked about how Jared Kushner has sort of had his eye on the idea of developing beachfront property. He's said that to one extent or another about Gaza. That's definitely been part of the ferment. I think Trump had mentioned that idea at least once or twice in the time before his election, but it's so outrageous on its face that I don't know if people really knew what to do about it. And at this point, he just seems to be pressing it. I don't understand the game theory, to your point, right? Like, I don't understand how this is supposed to move the needle, who this is supposed to motivate in terms of resolving the issue, but, you know.
Well, that's the other thing. If you really wanted to do this, this wouldn't be the approach. Yeah. You would do it subtly. I mean, for example, look, I'm sure there are some people in Gaza. I mean, their homes have been destroyed. They're living in tents who, in their heart of hearts, you know, if you said, hey, we got this nice home for you in some other country, they'd be like, not bad. But, of course, to begin with, it is like a point of national and ethnic pride that the Palestinians are not going to be pushed out of what they consider their homeland. I mean, especially when a lot of them were pushed to what is now their homeland from what they consider to be their homeland. So it's one of those things where, you know, even though it's a tempting thought, I'm sure it's not something you would like kind of say out loud in Palestine. And so maybe Trump, if you were to ask me, could anything at all come of this? I guess it would be in the form of him trying to find 1,000 Palestinians who would like to go and just establish the precedent and move them and then get them to go on TV saying, hey, this is wonderful. This is a nice spa, you know, or something. But if that's your game, he's not doing that the right way. You know, he's doing this in a way that immediately generates all this resistance, that immediately turns this into even more of a point of national and ethnic pride, not to be pushed out of your homeland. So I just, I do not buy the idea that this guy is in any sense intelligent. I'm sorry. He has good bully instincts and the kind of social political intelligence a good bully has. But he's an idiot. And much of his behavior could be explained by just wanting to get as much attention as possible, like that day.
Yeah. No, I mean,
that's
I think that's more or less true. I mean, it's a little hard to say. I just think his incentives are built, like you said, mostly around attention. This I do want to note, and we write about this in today's Earthling, that, you know, we bash, obviously, on the New York Times, Washington Post, often for many types of coverage, but the New York Times actually had a really, really excellent piece breaking down all of the ways in which this plan would violate international law. And we highlight some of those, you know, the idea of ethnic cleansing, you know, which has usually been called forced displacement under international law. The Times mentioned, you know, all the way back to 1863, the Union Army adopted the, I think, Lieber Code, it's called, which banned the movement of people, like carrying them off to far off places or something like that. And then that strengthened by the Fourth Geneva Convention in 1945, strengthened again by the Rome Statute, which came into force in 2002. It's worth just noting all these things because people usually don't, right? And then even on top of that, you know, to the great credit of the Times, they talk about the fact that, you know, this is not Israel's to give, right? Israel is not considered the sovereign of Gaza under international law. The state of Palestine, exercised through the Palestinian Authority as recognized by the United Nations, is the sovereign. And so only Abbas, the president of Palestine, the president of the Palestinian Authority, would be able to say that the U.S. can have it. And he is obviously not going to do that. He has already said he won't. So the international law is so just open and shut here.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, Trump would say, well, they'll go willingly. Well, I mean, when you've destroyed their homes and you know, and killed some of the relatives or whatever else you've done, you know, I mean, I would call that a form of coercion in and of itself.
Oh, yeah.
But as of now, it's not clear that any of them would agree to go, and none of the surrounding areas want them there. There was another good piece in the New York Times that I mentioned by Patricia Cohen, this about trade, which I gather, I haven't read it, but I gather there's an item in the newsletter that gets into this having to do with Trump's, on and off tariff wars against various countries.
Yeah. So the argument that we make in the lead this week for the Earthling in the first sort of longer item is essentially that, you know, Trump had this big sort of tariff back and forth with Mexico and Canada over the past weekend. He was able to get what seemed to be fairly superficial concessions, but succeeded, obviously, in really pissing off the leaders of Mexico and Canada. And what's interesting about that is I think it really reveals a consequential way in which Trump, and to a certain extent, lots of other people in the foreign policy community in D.C. misunderstand American power in the world today. So basically, I think a lot of people are still caught up in this idea that, like in the unipolar moment, the U.S. had a certain level of economic and military and diplomatic dominance that was more or less something that hadn't existed except in the few years after World War II. And we've got this idea that we can maintain that and that we're able to sort of use our economic leverage to use things like sanctions, tariffs, to sort of bully other states into doing what we want them to do. But the reality is, with the rise of China as a true economic competitor, whether or not it's a military mm-hmm. competitor, and the rise of much more powerful sort of so-called middle powers, right? The states like India and Canada, Mexico, all of these, there's no longer really an ability for the U.S. to say, if we stop trading with you, it's the end of the world, right? Like, obviously, Mexico and Canada want to trade with us, and they'd much prefer to trade with us, but states are seeing what's happening and seeing the U.S. sort of acting in erratic ways, and they, as the Patricia Cohen piece explains, right, are actually making deals that don't involve the U.S. and that encourage commerce between, say, the EU and South America, or even the EU and China. That's back on the table. Britain and the Trans-Pacific Partnership that the U.S. pulled out of. You know, all of these different trade things are opening, and the U.S. is sort of conspicuously absent.
Yeah, I found that piece kind of encouraging. You know, there's the they say that the internet was designed to route around damage. You know, something, you know, it just finds a way to right. keep the communication flowing. And I was reminded of that by this piece. You know, the idea that, you know, the impulse to trade is strong. It's a non-zero-sum game. There's two parties who will both benefit. I mean, it sometimes it's an oversimplification to say that the two nations will benefit. There are complicated consequences. It can be bad for workers in a given nation. But what I mean is the people right on the two ends of the trade, like the two companies doing the trade, they want to do it. They profit by doing it. And that's a strong impetus. And also, I am a fan of economic engagement generally. I think it's a pacifying force. I think you're less likely to go to war with a country to the extent that you're kind of deeply interconnected with them economically and culturally and so on. So I was encouraged just to think of it that way. Like, okay, so Trump is, you know, he's turned America into what in the internet metaphor is damage. But, you know, the world trade system routes around it. And that creates an incentive for the U.S. not to continue to get more and more segregated from the larger system. So, you know, we'll see. But I wasn't even aware of all these, you know, little kind of somewhat inchoate trade blocks. You know, some European countries and a few Latin American countries have some block I've never heard of. You know, I'm glad.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's something that we'll see more of. And it's not quite the, you know, there's sort of a narrative, especially popular on the left, around like de-dollarization, for example, in the global economy. That will be, if it does happen, a slow process. I don't think that there's any reason to believe that in the next 4 years of Trump, even if he goes all in on tariffs, that like the dollar will be replaced as the global reserve currency or something like that. But it just is clear that when you act as if you are sort of an unstoppable force at the top of the global economy and you exercise over and over, you know, your ability with sanctions, your ability with tariffs, it's just going to naturally erode that influence over time.
Yep. Did you hear what Marco Rubio said about the dollars? I think it was about the dollar's declining status, saying, you know, increasingly we're not going to be able to sanction, I think he said. It's like, I mean, it's true, but of course, he's the reason. I mean, he's no longer in neocon mode, but back when he was championing every sanction in the world and like abusing our central position in the in the world's financial system to coerce various countries into doing various things, you know, that's one of the things that is making it slowly undermining the power to do that. You know, creating incentives for other countries to trade in currencies other than the dollar and so on. No, it was funny. I just saw the snippet, but he said it like it was funny. He said it as like it's his insight and totally consistent with his worldview. And, you know, for years and years, it's the kind of thing you would say to him. You'd grab him by the shoulder and say, "Don't you understand?
Yeah,
you're undermining your own ability to do this in the future." But I don't know, his transition from neocon to American firster is impressive. And I actually think he's quite a political asset for Trump. He's very articulate and completely without principle. So he'll say anything Trump wants. He's a great asset for Trump.
Well, it really reveals too the way in which incentives are so much different for members of Congress than they are for members of an administration, right? It doesn't always lead to something this dramatic. But for example, like Nancy Pelosi throughout her career in Congress has always been extremely hawkish towards China, taking steps like that. Rubio, when he was in the Senate, was extremely hawkish towards everyone in the world. But part of that is because they see almost no downside in looking strong, right? In kind of puffing out their chest and saying that, like, we'll stand up to our enemies. But once you're actually in office, like, you have to deal with the world as it is to a certain extent. And so I think, you know, that combined with this sort of America First, whatever you want to call it, movement has really created an interesting shift in Rubio.
Yeah. So what else?
What are we doing? Do you want to talk about AI?
There's AI and there's the PKK.
Right.
It's your call. You're more of a PKK guy. I'm more of an AI guy.
Why don't we start with AI? I feel like I've talked a decent amount so far. So, and then we should do at the end of AI, maybe head to our overtime part of this conversation where we can talk more about that. But first, yeah, I mean, tell me a little bit about, you wrote in an item this week for the Earthling about or related to a conversation that you have that's coming out soon, if you want to kind of tell listeners about that.
Yeah. I mean, a couple of good AI-related conversations on the podcast feed. One is already up with Paul Triolo, who's a true expert on Chinese technology, kind of, to some extent, a deep dive on the whole DeepSeek thing, you know, this Chinese reasoning model that freaked everybody out. That's already up. And then there's a conversation that I have not posted yet with Dan Hendricks, who is a very prominent figure in AI safety circles and in AI, you know, research circles. I mean, he's done important work in so-called interpretability, like understanding what's going on inside the AIs, like where are concepts represented? Can you manipulate the concepts and so on? And he's head of the Center for AI Safety, which sponsored one of the two big statements that a lot of people you've heard of signed like a couple of years ago, the one on existential risk. Anyway, what that conversation turned out to be relevant to, we're holding the conversation for posting until a paper he co-authored comes out, because that's what most of the conversation was about. But there's a little bit about something else that's relevant to this kind of big development this week, actually. I think OpenAI released this model called Deep Research. I mean, it's basically its most sophisticated reasoning model. You know, reasoning, that's a category of large language models that's only been around for a few months. And in this case, what Deep Research is, that's the name it's given it, is harnessing this most sophisticated reasoning model to web search capabilities. So you can assign it any research task, and it really does more than just go out and gather the relevant things and say, here's what people are saying. It actually does a certain amount of reasoning and analysis. Mm-hmm. And like Ethan Mollick, who is, I think, kind of America's alpha AI watcher. He's a professor at Wharton who just deservedly has a big following, and a very active Twitter feed and a newsletter called One Useful Thing. And he said he has heard, you know, this has never happened with any other AI product. He's heard from a number of people in a number of fields in senior positions who just without, you know, unsolicited, you know, contacted him and said, man, this thing is making me rethink the future of my work. Always meaning I'm going to be out of a job, but sometimes meaning, wow, this postdoc that I use, you know, senior faculty member uses a postdoc, or maybe somebody in corporate America, whatever, who has various kinds of assistants. I mean, these people, he said he's never seen anything like it. And I have heard good things. In fact, Nathan Labenz, who does the Cognitive Revolution podcast, he's been on my podcast. He said it's the first thing that could almost replace him as a preparer for his podcast, at like researching the other person and deciding what you're going to ask.
That's pretty crazy.
No, it's a real race, but I mean, it's funny. Google had come out with something called also deep research in December. And I got to think, Altman, that basically has the same job description, but Google hasn't yet harnessed it to its most sophisticated reasoning model. And it's, so it's not as good. And I got to think Altman chose the same name by way of saying, yeah, compare us to theirs and see what you think, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, the part that Dan Hendricks is relevant to is the question arises, you know, Altman said after the DeepSeek thing, Altman said, he tweeted like, hey, we welcome the competition. We're going to accelerate the release of some products. And then like, you know, 10 days later or something, boom, this drops. So it looks like this is one of the products he meant. And, you know, the question arises, this is really powerful, and has it been adequately tested? And Dan Hendricks is skeptical. He said it's speculative. He doesn't know for sure, but with the 03 mini reasoning model, there was a whole phase of testing that he was aware of, standard phase of red teaming, that he's not aware of having happened with the 03 as opposed to 03 mini, which is what drives deep research. And so he's just raising the question. He can't say for sure, but he says all signs are that this, from what he can see, this did not undergo the kind of testing that, and it just, I mean, I'm sure they tried to build guardrails into it. It just has a lot more capacity to do something like figure out, like research how to build a bioweapon, which it would refuse to do. But if you do the right prompt engineering, I mean, that's the whole point of red teaming, is seeing whether sufficiently creative prompting can break the guardrails. So anyway, there's that. But the conversation with Dan is great. And we put in the newsletter is that part of the transcript with Dan where we discuss that.
Yeah, and speaking of AI safety stuff, we do mention also somewhere near the top of the newsletter that there's this very interesting, you know, if you want to see the opposite approach from what may have happened kind of there with OpenAI, that Anthropic, the maker of Claude, is now essentially asking people to try to jailbreak it and making it sort of gamified. And it's quite interesting, you know, it's very relevant to us too, because the questions that they're trying to answer are all related to the manufacture of chemical weapons, which is obviously something that you've talked about, something that is a pretty significant fear, right? If you can use this to manufacture bioweapons, chemical weapons, things like that, it's a real concern. But so far, no one has claimed. There's like a $20,000 prize, and no one has earned it yet. So,
yeah. So get busy.
Yeah. All right. Well, so we should probably get headed toward overtime now. But, you know, thank you to everyone who has listened so far. In overtime, we're going to be talking about a lot of stuff, including, what I think could be one of the bigger developments in the Middle East in quite a while, having to do with the PKK. Also want to talk about Trump's freeze on spending related to what he calls the Green New Deal, but what is essentially just all climate-related spending that the federal government does. Is there anything that you would add, Bob?
No, I don't know that much about this. No, there's an item in the newsletter about this.
About the green funding?
Yeah.
Yeah, there is. It's interesting. I mean, the thing that I'll really want to get your thoughts on is the fact that this has apparently been blocked by the courts, this funding freeze, but Trump seems to be in sort of explicit violation of that order. So this poses some challenging questions for the whole Trump freakout meter that we should eventually make.
Is this the clearest case so far of him actually ignoring a court order? Because so far, I think he's complied, right? There's the birthright citizenship thing, the freeze, the job buyout thing pending further a hearing that starts on Monday.
Yeah.
And there's other stuff. But are they saying he's just saying screw you on this one?
That's what Politico says.
Well, I mean, that's the danger, is that, that at some point he says he's going to make me.
Yeah, no, exactly. Well, look, we can save more conversation about this for every time. But again, thanks to everyone who joined so far. And for those of you who are members, we will be on the other side of the paywall in a second.
This was a free preview of Non-Zero World. To unlock the rest of this conversation and other exclusive content, become an NZN member today at nonzero.org.